Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show Alternative Medicine and Wellness. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us this evening, live on Blog Talk Radio, Sedona Talk Radio, and on iTunes. Thank you so much for being with us. We are going to be talking about a great topic this evening. It's called fulfilling life. Do you even know what that word means? Everybody says, oh, I lived a full life. What does that mean? And I think it's really important to talk about it because, you know, I'm almost 60 now, and we look at our lives and we say, oh, I did everything I wanted to do, or see all these experiences I did. It was really a great thing. But now, I think you could probably say in the last 10 years, is that a lot of people are saying, you know, my life is not exactly what I really wanted it to be, what I may have dreamt about, or maybe what I thought I would be doing. I kind of just went with the flow, thought that's what I was supposed to be doing, and yep, got money in the bank, Cadillac in the parking lot, and four houses, I'm good to go. So what really is life about? We're going to be talking about that this evening. And my guest is BJ Gallagher. Yep, same last name. Cool, huh? It's Never Too Late to Be What You Might Have Been is the name of her book, and it's a guide to getting the life you love. And it's really a wonderful book because there's a lot of tips, dialogue, many quotes, but there's tons of stories. And what's important about the stories is hearing how other people may have done something in their life and say, you know, I wasn't quite understanding what they meant, but I can read it in the story. Or maybe you read the story and you say, well, I didn't quite get that. And you turn the page and there's a bunch of tips. And you're like, oh, okay, action steps. I can do that. So the book is a wonderful guidepost to be able to say what is it that's so important about life. And BJ is a wonderful author, and she has had over 40 books. She is a workshop leader, and she's also been several times on the Today Show, and she also has been on the pages of the Los Angeles Times to the New York Times. And it's really wonderful to have her with us because, you know, everybody sees something differently. I had this conversation today with a wonderful healer, and they were telling me about their work, and it was like, okay, but we're all speaking a different language, and we're expecting everybody to understand it. And you know what? They don't really understand it. We're going to really need to start breaking things down so other people can hear the words, hear the different languages, and say, what is a dream? What is a fulfilled life? And why should I even care? And that's why we're here this evening. And welcome to the show, BJ. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Jeanette. It's great to be here. I think we must be related some generations back in Ireland someplace.
Absolutely.
It's the first time I've been interviewed by another Gallagher.
Oh, that is so interesting. Absolutely, you know. I looked back at Ancestry.com, and I think only two generations back, and they were all from Ireland, you're for sure.
I'm sure.
Well, don't you think it's been really in the last several years that people are saying, you know, what is a fulfilling life? And I really wanted to talk about that today because you talk about a dream and, you know, a life, and people are saying, depending on where you are in the span, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, on up to 60s and 80s, everybody's got a different version of it, don't you think?
I do. And years ago when I was in graduate school, I did some research on autobiographies and found that there were a couple of great periods in history when autobiographies flourished. And what characterized those times was the breakdown of social order and the decline in influence in a dominant institution. And I think that's part of why people are looking within themselves, because it used to be they would look to the church for moral guidance,
right,
or they'd look to government on how to run their lives, or they'd look to, you know, business or what. But all the big institutions are under siege, and we've got a lot of economic turmoil and unsettledness. And in times like that, people look within. They stop looking outside themselves for answers, and they start looking inside themselves for answers. And that's when they start to question, is this where I want to be? What do I want to do with the rest of my life? What's it all about? Why am I even here? They start asking themselves the big questions.
You know, and that's interesting you said that, because just today on the New York Times, on their health columns, it was talking about the ministry and how they felt that they are now the mental health counselors, because people are really not getting the answers that they need from their physicians, or they don't even trust them, or they haven't gone to them, whatever that setup might be. But if you look at it, they're really going back into their core and saying, my soul or my spirit is not well. Something in me, inside me, not outside of my physical body,
right,
but something inside of me is hurting and is in pain, and I can't do it anymore. And they're going to their ministry, their pastors, their rabbis, their church, whatever that might be. And the church is really taking a hit right now, because they say they're not equipped to be able to handle those questions and those answers. I mean,
yeah.
I grew up in the 50s and the 60s in Roman Catholic up in the Northeast. All we knew about church, you know, Roman Catholic, was you read the catechism, you would read these words, you'd answer them and make sure they were done right, you know, and you did what you were told to do. And it's not like that anymore. And so all of our things that we thought were going on in life are kind of so challenged right now. It's no wonder that if you took a room of 100 people, you know, maybe 35 years ago, 40 years ago, they'd say, are you having a fulfilling life? Do you know what you're doing? And they're like, oh, yeah, everything's cool. Everything's great. And you look at it now, probably out of 100, you might get to maybe 3 out of the whole room.
Mm-hmm.
Big difference.
Right. I that's really interesting. And I think the I'm encouraged to hear what you say about churches, because I think they're being asked to do what their job was all along. And somehow they lost track of it, that their job is to help people do soul work, to be a witness, to be a companion along the spiritual path, to, you know, to teach people, to guide people. And I think the reason people aren't going to physicians as much is they know what they'll get. They'll get a pill. And a pill isn't what they're after. They really want to get at what ails them spiritually and emotionally. And I also think that people have discovered in the last few decades the connection between body and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And in Western medicine, historically, there was a split. Medicine dealt with body, and somebody else's job was to deal with spirit, the church or shamans or gurus or whoever. And now that alternative medicine has helped people discover, oh, there's a connection. This headache means something. This frozen shoulder is, you know, might have emotional roots. They're seeing the connection, and they're asking their spiritual teachers to help them do their soul work.
You know, and as I've been in healthcare since, gosh, I think it was 73, and in all different realms, and even lately as a naturopathic physician, you know, when a patient comes in to me and says, you know, oh, well, there's something wrong, I've got a pain in my chest, and the first question you ask them is why is your spirit broken? And they look at you like you have 10 eyes, you know. But the people that will be able to understand it will show up at your door. But then going back to the church, too, we think, aren't these clergy or whatever in any parts of the church the ones supposed to be able to guide you along? And when you're coming into them and saying something, I have a pain here, I have a pain, and they always put their hand to their chest, is it your heart, your spirit, or your soul? They're saying the same thing.
Right.
It's just that no one is listening. And I think that is, if you could write a banner across the sky, you could say, hey, everybody's having these issues, everybody's having all these things go on, but no one is listening. And I would always bring it back to when you go to an MD. When you go to an MD school, the first rule of thumb is do not ask, do not diagnose that which you do not know how to treat. They're not going to ask you about certain things because
they don't know what to do with the answer. Oh, that's
correct.
Interesting.
Because, well, not only that, but once you document it on your chart, you must have, by all rules of medicine, you know, you ask the question, you open the door, you ran test, you just stood your foot in the room, and now you have to give a treatment, and it's like you must fix it. So those three paradigms is all across the board, and people need to really recognize that. You know, physicians have their limitations. mm-hmm. then we go back to the clergy, and the clergy are based upon the Bible. They need to read this, they need to read that. This is the way they've, quote, done it for hundreds and centuries or whatever it might be, or since the beginning of time, and God wrote this book or whatever. But really, again, it's another same thing, is they are not asking the right questions because they also cannot diagnose, nor can they treat. If I sat down and said to you, is your soul not working? They're going to say, you know, you say, it must be something inside of me isn't. What are they going to say then? Are they going to say, well, this is how you can fix your soul? I don't think so.
Right.
You know, they're going to say, go say the rosary, go to church. I don't know. But they don't have the answers.
Well, that probably helps explain the continuing decline of membership in mainstream churches that's been going on for decades now. It's nothing new. And what we're seeing in its place is a rise in spiritual teachers, Marianne Williamson, Louise Hay, Esther Hicks. I mean, there are some wonderful spiritual teachers, Byron Katie, who are drawing people, flocks from all over the world, because they didn't find their answers in the mainstream church. So they're looking for other spiritual teachers. They're going to Buddhism. They're going to Native American shamans. They're going to all sorts of alternative Asian religions, as well as new religions or new spiritual paths, I'll call them, rather than religions. And you know, they're just going like gangbusters because the church is failing.
Yes. And also, is not the healthcare system also the same way? So all of these things we're finding, and I think we are right at the precipice, I would say at the tipping point of saying, my life is not working, and you have to identify what's not working to be able to give you a great life. And you're saying, okay, let's check off the list. This didn't work, that didn't work, that didn't work, and now what's left? And what I really think the whole focus is it's not all of that outside stuff. It's really inside you, and it's up to you to find it for you. We all can't do it for anybody. I can't, even me as a physician, you know, I can't fix it for you. All I can do is sit here, listen to you, and I'm going to bounce back to you what I hear, and we're just going to have a tit for tat. We're going to go back and forth, and you know, I might say something that'll challenge you. I might say something that'll make you laugh. I might say something that'll get you mad. But then you'll be able to start rising out of yourself, and I think that's where we're really at, don't you think?
Right. Well, one of the things I always tell my clients is that nobody can do it for you, but you can't do it alone. That we need a witness, we need a coach, we need a counselor, we need a doctor, we need somebody, we need help because we often can't see our own stuff because we're in the middle of it. When I do a lot of organizational consulting, I think of myself as an organizational physician, and a company will call me, an executive or a manager will call me when there's some sort of pain in the in the body of the organization. And so I just go in there and I do a physical. I say, well, okay, so tell me what's going on. Tell me what's working well. Tell me what isn't working well. Tell me where it hurts. Where's the pain? Because they may not know what's wrong, but they know what hurts. And so then we'll look at the pain, and we do it together. So it's not, I don't come in and write a report and tell them what's wrong and tell them how to fix it. I'm simply a partner, a witness, a mirror. I often say that my job is really simple. My job is to ask good questions and manage the process. And that's it. They will diagnose what their own problem is if I'm a good question asker. And they will come up with their own solutions if I'm a good – it's the Socratic method. Mm-hmm. It's nothing new. It's asking good questions that lead people on a journey of discovery, so they discover their own dis-ease and they also discover their own possible cures, or at least they've got a few things they can try to resolve their own pain. So – I do it a little bit with individuals, but much more with groups, with teams, with departments, with companies, And you know, it's really fun to be a witness and an assistant on their journey.
Absolutely. And I think that in turn will give you the life that you love. So that's really what we have both just said, you know, over the time periods and how different people do it is they find the way, the life you would love. How do you find the life you would love is you have to find it inside first, because mm-hmm. you can't keep looking outside for someone else to plop the Band-Aids on and fix you. You know, mm-hmm. and you, yourself, your finances, your company, your work, whatever it might be, you know, your relationships or anything, nobody can, quote, fix it. It's really up to you to either shift change in how you're thinking about it or shift change in what you're doing about it. And that all has to come just from you.
Yeah, although there's plenty of people out there willing to tell you that they can fix
it. Oh,
you.
Yes.
They're willing to sell you all
yes.
sorts of things, you know, programs, coaching, books,
mm-hmm.
retreats, if not, you know, the new sexy automobile or the coolest
yeah.
high heels or whatever. I mean, there's plenty of folks who are using that, who are using our emotional pain to try
yeah.
to sell us stuff that they assert will fix it all and make it all go away. It's this.
And we
have this little dance of collusion that
yes.
that we take our pain, and for many years, it takes a long time for people to come to realize that
mm-hmm.
that it isn't an outside job; it's an inside job. So most of us spend years looking for something outside, thinking, "Well, I could just find the right teacher, the right guru, the right car, the right
mm-hmm.
girlfriend, the right house, the right job, the right boyfriend, the right. If I could just
yeah.
find it, my life would be fine." And then there's plenty of people out there trying to sell them on that idea, and we do this little dance together. It's
and
only
you know
when
what,
we stop dancing and go, nope, I'm going to go inside because I tried everything outside and it didn't work. So, I must be confused. I must be confused.
But don't you think also, too, we as human beings have really need to start opening our own eyes, because everybody is looking for that fast cure. You know, they will go to the physician.
Especially
and we're
Americans.
We are so not going to knock MDs because, look, we need them. You know, we need everybody
we
that's
like
here.
Our magic
we need
bullets.
Yes, but we need
we like
everything that we can.
Yes.
Because
yes,
those,
yes.
Go ahead.
We have to laugh at ourselves. I mean, we really are silly
oh, yeah.
creatures, you know, we want that quick fix. We want it instantly. Now, there are people in other cultures who don't think that way. The Asian
mm-hmm.
cultures in particular have a much longer term, you know, point of view. And, you know, they're much more patient and, you know, they just take a different, they're not as into instant gratification as Americans are. We are really the instant gratification kings and queens.
Yeah.
I want it all, and I want it now.
And I think the internet has made things worse, too, because if one person doesn't give you the answer that you want or the fix that you want, you'll just go along until you find someone that does. And now that we have the internet, there's tons of people out there who will give you exactly what you want as
absolutely.
You define it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, there's a snake oil salesman on every website.
Absolutely. Well, you know,
but that's okay.
BJ.
You know, we're in charge of our own lives and our own destinies, and we're entitled to make some mistakes and do some silly things and try, you know, following some gurus. And when that doesn't work, then we'll try something else. So, I mean, that's just how most of us learn. We make a lot of mistakes, and when we wise up.
But I also think life is for experiencing, too. Wouldn't we be awful bored if we found the answers when we were really young? You know? I mean, I like to think that way. Let's all agree. Okay.
Right. I don't know anybody who has that problem. Maybe the
That's
Dalai
right.
Lama, maybe he found his answers pretty young, you know, because he became the Dalai Lama. He was designated the Dalai Lama at a very young age. So,
mm-hmm.
But who knows? Maybe he's still discovering new answers, too. We don't
Absolutely.
Know.
So let's talk about your book. You say about
sure.
making your dreams come true. You know, let's talk about what a dream is, because, you know, people say I didn't have a dream, I had a nightmare, you know, and sometimes that nightmare is reality in your face. You know, so I think that's pretty important to look at too. But what really is a dream? And a lot of people say it's pie in the sky. And I've even had a little child say to me one time, there's a pie in the sky and they're looking up there, you know, and you're going, yeah, you know, that's exactly the truth. Those
dreams are pie in the sky,
you know. So what is a dream or a nightmare?
Well, it's whatever you say it is. It's different for different people. And one person's dream might be another person's nightmare. So it's a very individual thing. You know, it's just an individual thing. People have to decide for themselves what's important to them, what do they think would make them happy. They often have to try different things and find that, oh, well, that dream wasn't as dreamy as I thought it was going to be. So I think I'll pick a different dream. That we don't always get it right the first time or the third time or the tenth time. You know, our dreams may change over the years.
But you think there's ever one answer? See, I don't think that there... I think for some people there is that one answer and you go and you fulfill it and they call you an old soul and that's when you're here. However, if you really look at it, a lot of people, they have a dream and they'll say, oh, I just would love to, you know, drive a Cadillac. So they get the Cadillac and they're like, okay, well, that quite wasn't the dream I was looking for. But they have these little incremental goals in their life. But in a way, that is their life. They're able to move forward. When a lot of people sit down and dream, I like to say that's like having your feet in cement. You know, you're just dreaming your life away, but you're not really an active participant in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so vitally important because even these ones that, you know, dream something crazy, they go out and get it and it doesn't fulfill them, they still made action. They still participated in life. They didn't just sit there and, you know, watch for the pie in the sky, which will never come, right?
Right. And they learned something about themselves. I spent a few years doing the online dating thing, which was a really wonderful, people roll their eyes and go, oh, God. But I actually found it a wonderful process because I thought I wanted to get married. I thought I wanted a husband.
Right.
And through the process I worked with, there's a wonderful woman here in Los Angeles, Dr. Pat Allen, and I worked with her for 3 years, and her whole specialty is helping people find partners. They're helping particularly women, but she also works with men who want to get married or whatever kind of partnership they're looking for. And so I just followed her method and did what she told me to do. And I learned so much about myself in the process. I learned an enormous amount about men, but I learned even more things about myself, like, oh, I didn't realize that was important to me, or, oh, I never thought about that coming up in a relationship, or it was a great process of values clarification, self-understanding, insight into the other, the other gender that I really didn't understand very well. It was a great experience that I couldn't have learned that stuff by reading a book or sitting and thinking about it. I had to get out there and, you know, probably went out on 150 dates over 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just had to get out there and do it. And, boy, I learned a lot. And one of the things I learned is, oh, I really love freedom. I really love, there's a reason I'm single. I say I want to be married, but when I look back on my life, I think, well, let's see, I was engaged to that guy, and I was engaged to that guy, and I was married to that one, and oh, and there were these other guys who would have married me in a heartbeat. Well, gee, maybe I really don't want to be married because my actions tell me otherwise. My mouth says I want to be married. My actions tell me, no, I want to be free.
Yes.
I wouldn't
know if I hadn't done that. That's right. And, I mean, I've done just the opposite. I've just married them and just kept going through them.
Uh-huh.
And because I really needed experiences. It was something that, you know, and when I kept growing, and this is very important also, I find you do highlight it in the book, is that we are growing as human beings. And as I kept growing and doing different things and going on and, you know, getting other degrees or having kids or, you know, wanting to move somewhere else or whatever that was, if the other person is not also growing too, that's a very difficult thing. So we meet people or we do things in our life to fulfill us at that moment, but as we keep growing, we can grow up and out of that, and it's not a bad thing.
Right. That's one of the challenges of marriage today, is that we just live so darn long. And when marriage was invented eons ago, people didn't live that long. They died in their 40s. I mean, they got or in their 30s. They got married in their teens. They had their families. They raised them, and boom, they died. And so the expectations of marriage have risen, that we expect more and more and more from marriage. Also, love wasn't always a part of the equation. In history, marriage was about economic security, particularly for women. It was about family alliances. It was about property. It was about status. It was about all, you know, and love was sort of way down there on the totem pole. If you got love, that was a nice bonus. But today, we want it all. We want love and status and money and success and fulfillment, and we just put enormous demands on our marital partners, and it's no accident that the divorce rate's over 50%.
You know, but also too, I think we don't really have the same responsibilities or the same respect for humans either that we used to have a long time ago. My grandmothers, both of them, their husbands died very, very early in life, and they just continued on their life by themselves, and the grandmothers didn't die until they were in their 99, 100 years. But they just continued to believe, you know, that life was good and everything was great. And I don't ever remember them saying or whining about anything at all, ever. Now it's people, you know, you can't give them 24 hours and they're complaining about something, you know. And it's just, I think it's gotten too common where we are saying, my life isn't working at this moment, so I have to fix it right now. And, you know, I have to look at your life as an overall general scenario, not just for in the moment to say it's not working, it's not fulfilling, blah, blah, you know? Really?
It's a case of managing our own expectations, because we, again, and this is a particularly American phenomenon, our expectations seem to be rising with each generation. And so it makes it harder and harder for people to feel fulfilled and happy, because as soon as they have one thing, they want the next thing. And so what used to be a luxury is now a necessity. And rather than all this wonderful stuff we have in our lives making us happier, it actually makes us unhappier, because we can't keep up. You know, we just, it's a problem of rising expectations. I look at the political scene, and Obama's a really good example of that. When he first got elected 6 years ago, people's expectations were through the roof. I mean, it's like and I just thought, oh my God, we're in for trouble here, because no matter how talented or how smart or how skillful he is not the Messiah, and he is never going to live up to everybody's expectations. And sure enough, it didn't take long for people to go, well, he's not doing this, and he's not doing that, and he's not supporting his own people, and this and that. And I think we did this to ourselves, and we did it to him by having completely unrealistic. We expect our president to be God, Santa Claus, Mommy, Daddy, Moses, Gandhi, and Jesus, and Muhammad all wrapped up into one.
Absolutely.
And no human being can do that. And yet, you know, we set them up with these crazy expectations, and then we tear them down when they disappoint us. We do that somewhat to our romantic partners sometimes, too.
And I think we also do it to our family relationships, too, because if you think back, you know, I can remember, you know, a long time ago, decades and decades ago, you know, mothers and fathers did the best they could. You know, 50s, 60s, and 70s. 80s and 90s, parents were expected to do a little more. Now in the year after 2000, it's like, my gosh, the parents nowadays, I mean, I say to my kids all the time, I would never want to be a parent now because I could not keep up.
Right.
You know? This idea that we have to give constant love, compassion, and attention to our children 24/7, you know, and how many, you know, you're leaving the child off at kindergarten, you're saying, oh, I love you 100 times, the child's saying back, you know, oh, I love you more, and the mother's going, oh, I love you more, and it's like, oh, goodness gracious, you
yes.
know, because we've really set them up for this paradigm that I'm not sure who's going to be able to, I mean, I don't know where the world is going. You know what I'm saying?
When they get out there into the real world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then
and,
I'm wondering,
yes,
do you think that the world will support them? I think the world is changing so much. It may be that world, the world that they're growing up in is the world that we will be changing into. So I think the world will be shifting. It's mm-hmm. just we're all older people are sitting back and going, we're looking at the world in awe, whereas
wow,
these
right.
young children are just thinking of it as, hey, yeah, this is what we're this is us. This is what it is.
Yep. Yep.
Scary.
It's interesting. You know, each generation is a little different, and each generation's expectations are different. And so, you know, time will tell. We'll see how they turn out.
Yep, and you also talk in your book about it's never too late to go back to school. Ha, I could tell you a little story about that one. So I had my one degree in the 70s on dental hygiene, and then I wanted to go back to be a naturopathic physician when I was in my 40s, and they were like, well, you know all of those degrees in education you had 20 years ago? You need to do it all over again. And I'm like, what?
Wow.
And so just a little heads up for anybody that says, I want to go back to school. There is a limit on what you take at school and how long you should go back.
Yeah. It's like your knowledge.
If anyone has ever
experienced. They're telling you your knowledge becomes obsolete.
Yes. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've taken anatomy, you know.
Wow, that's interesting.
Because they would constantly say, well, it's more than 10 years, you got to do it again, you got to do it again. Physics, you have to do it again. Chemistry, you have to do it again. I'm going like, it didn't change, people.
Wow,
you know?
That's really something.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's great to say let's go back to school, but do keep aware of that. But I think going back to school, too, there's a big learning curve now. I mean, elderly parents, you know, that want to go back to school, it's like, you mean I have to use what kind of instant teleseminar? And what was that word, webinar? You know?
Uh-huh.
So the learning curve is very fast and rapid. If you can get on the train, you'll be pretty much going, you'll be doing well.
Yeah. Well, particularly for people who want to change fields, that,
mm-hmm.
You know, going back to school can be a good option. Say you spent 20 years doing one thing. I remember my dad was in the military. He was an Air Force officer and a pilot for over 30 years. And he was still a young man. He was just over 50, I guess. And
mm-hmm.
was he even 50? Wasn't sure he was even 50 anyway. But he knew he was going to be getting out of the service, and he was still a young man. He certainly wasn't going to retire at 48 or 50. And
right.
so he picked up an MBA from
right.
Auburn University when he was stationed in Alabama, and then went on to a second career as a banker and worked as
yeah.
a banker for 15 years. So going back to school can be a great way to make a career pivot if you want to move
mm-hmm.
from one thing to another, not just military people who often find that they have a hard time translating their skills to the civilian world. So sometimes a degree can help them do that, particularly if it's a business degree of some kind. But, you know, lots of people who want to, you know, move from one thing to another.
Yeah, and
it's
also not to be afraid of it, though, too. You just have to step out because there will be other people also doing that. I mean, if you look at the decline of the banks and the homes that they had and mortgages over the past, what was that now, 10 years, there's a lot of people out there on second, third, and fourth professions.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I when I was doing interviews for the book, I remember talking to one young man, I think he was 28, and he said he'd already reinvented himself twice. And because
yeah.
he'd started off to be a musician, and he hadn't made it by the time he was in his early 20s. So he switched to something else for a few years and then decided he didn't like that. So he switched to a third career, and he said, the world is changing so fast, and we live so long that it's reasonable to expect that everybody's going to have to reinvent themselves several times, and sometimes it can start when you're quite young. So even though the people in my book are all over 40, that's not to say that people in their 20s and 30s might not have to reinvent themselves too.
Absolutely. And also in your book, you talk about being creative. I think that is really a great way for some people to say, this makes me happy today. You look back on maybe I guess it was around the 70s, a lot of people were doing a lot of canning and things, and that was when that became big. And they would start, you know, feeding their families. That's what they thought. And now the grandchildren of those people that lived in those time frames are now saying, well, we're going to do canning too, but we're going to sell it. And how wonderful that is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the creative stories were really interesting. One of the women I wrote about was, speaking of military, she was in the Army for 20 years. She was an intelligence officer. And along the way, I think she had volunteered, or after there was a natural disaster someplace, Hurricane Katrina or something, I forget where it was. And so she and some other soldiers got involved in rehabbing houses for the local citizens. And she discovered she loved it so much that that's what she wanted to do. And as soon as she could retire, as soon as she hit 20 years, she got out of the Army and became an artist. And her art form is redoing old houses. And it's just wonderful. And I thought, wow, she went from an Army intelligence officer to restoring fabulous old houses. How cool is that? And,
absolutely.
You know, she's still a young woman. I mean, she was only, if she retired after 20, I mean, she's only in her 40s. She might do something else too. You never know.
Yes, because I know when, after Katrina, when, you know, that I was here and we all got flooded in and lost everything. And we all found that, you know, just afterwards, people had to do what they had to do. So a lot of people started saying, well, I will do this as a business because their jobs were gone or their house was gone or whatever it might be. I mean, no one ever can understand the loss unless you've been there. And I think we just realized what was important in life and what isn't. And then one day I was driving down the street on Canal Street, downtown New Orleans, and I had stopped to the red light, and I looked to the right, and all of our graves are above ground here.
Right.
And right in between the two was a brand new moped. And I took a picture of it. I said, you know, you just can't take it with you, you know. and that's so vitally important to remember. You cannot take it with you, people.
Right.
So you may
right.
as well just enjoy what you have when you have it and move on.
And when it's
you
gone,
know?
It's gone. Yeah.
It's gone.
And one of the things that I discovered during the recession was that there were many people I talked to, including in my own family, who lost everything in the recession but got something better out of it. They discovered family relationships as people had to move back home to live with their parents or grandparents. And, you know, I heard countless stories of people talking about something that seemed like it was awful when it happened, and it turned out to be a blessing.
You know what is the number one thing you learned that was the best thing ever? I don't have to clean that house anymore. You know? And you think about all of the stuff that you had in the attic and, you know, and the I'm saving this for this kid and saving this one for that one and, you know, oh, well, I just have to keep this for this, that, and the other reason and those tchotchkes all over the place and, you know, those stupid receipts for the income tax and everything. Hey, it was great. Just wipe that slate clean, honey. And, you know, when the IRS calls you, you know, 2-3 years later, all you have to do is Hurricane Katrina. Oh, okay, bye. You know, you learn that people just leave you alone, you know, because that stuff just does not make any sense anymore.
Well, you see things differently. When the recession hit, my son was hit particularly hard. He wasn't yet 40. I think he was about 39, but he had been working really hard his for, you know, 20 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
He was he had a really nice job with Warner Brothers. He was an audio engineer with Warner Brothers. He had a house out in the valley. He leveraged all the equity in that house because real estate prices were crazy. So he took all his equity out and he bought 6 houses over in Phoenix and was renting them out. I mean, he was a, I called him, you know, my son, the landlord, my son, the real estate mogul. And he was driving a Jaguar and he was engaged to a beautiful girl. And then he bought a $1 million house in the Hollywood Hills. And then everything came crashing down.
Yeah.
Everything came crashing down, and all of his real estate values tanked. He got fired from his job at Warner Brothers. The the Jaguar was repossessed. The girlfriend left. He did manage to get out of the Hollywood Hills house before it totally tanked. And he ended up living in my basement for a year and a half.
Yeah.
But he will tell you today that losing everything was the best thing that ever happened to him because he found his way back to God. He started studying with the Tibetan Lama. He went to India on a pilgrimage and spent weeks over there studying. And he's happier than he's ever been. And his lifestyle is so simple now. He lives in a 3-bedroom rent-controlled apartment. He got rid of all of his furniture and everything. He's got a, you know, he kept his car, he kept his dog, and his musical equipment. And he said, but I he said everything had to be stripped away. But what I found was all that stuff was empty. Because every time I'd buy a new house, it would be like, well, this is nice. What's next? What's next?
Yeah.
And he said, I was never, he said it was fun, but I wasn't happy. And now he's happy.
Because that brought us right back to the beginning of our conversation. It's still on the inner side of what's important to you. I have seen people fall into their deepest depths when they've given up their everything that they've done. Actually, they've given up their lives to take care of a loved one or a family relative that may have Alzheimer's or dementia. That is when you just sit there and you just say, what is the core of this life? And really, that's when you realize that absolutely nothing is important except human beings. That's it. Sorry. You know,
and
no matter how many times you shake it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm doing that with my mother now. My mother has Alzheimer's, and she fell in March and broke her hip. And had, you know, that was a real game changer. So she couldn't live at home anymore. And so I go down to San Diego every week for a couple of days. And I she lives in a sweet little board and care place. And I hire people to take her out. And I go down and take her out. And when two things I realized. One is I realized that all that stuff she had in that house, which I'm liquidating to get that, it's she doesn't need that stuff anymore. She never needed it. That she just needs a few changes of clothes, a bed, a shower, a toilet, food, and love and attention. That's all. And when I'm with her, it's like I'm in the presence of pure love. She just looks at me, and that's all she wants is just to be with
me.
And I think, it all comes down to this. This is great.
Yeah.
This is just great.
And so no matter how many times you try to put a Band-Aid on it saying I need wealth or I need a career or I need all of these other jobs and, you know, I've just gotta have, it really, all that gotta have is all going to go away anyway when you get older. So, you know, you do it for the experience and enjoy your life, but also don't put so much vested into it that you forget who you are inside.
Most of us have to learn that one way or another. We either learn it by losing stuff or we learn it through some sort of an illness or a life-changing event. You know, most people learn that, but they have to learn it along the way.
But some learn it and they get angry about it, which is even worse. In other words, the world did it to them, you know?
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And, you know, somebody did it to me, you know, I didn't deserve this or what, you know, and then you get people angry at God. And is that really the answer? And that's not really, because we always say to people on this show, I always say, you didn't get dropped here by the stork. Someone, something, some energy put you here.
Right.
So you best start paying attention, pure and simple.
Yep.
to whatever
that
might be.
Well, it would be great if we could learn these lessons when we're young, but most of us generally don't. Or as my dad used to say, it's too bad that youth is wasted on the young. He said,
yes.
You know, you get wise when you're old. It's too bad you couldn't be wise when you're young.
Yeah, but don't you think we've heard them several different times in different ways along the way? We've just had different reactions to them, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we have.
Yep, we've gone out, we've had fun, we've done things, and life has just rolled all the way around. Well, BJ,
yeah,
it's been an absolute...
We do find how wise our parents were, that the things they...
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, my parents were right all along. Oh, my goodness. It's very humbling.
And I think that when we look at it, we really realize that everybody has something to tell us or teach us or be with us or whatever. In other words... We can't walk through this life with closed eyes or blinders on, because that's where a lot of us are right now. And missing that, you will really miss having a fulfilled life, because just look around and see what's going on around you.
I heard somebody say once that, how did they say it? That we live life going forward, but we can only understand it looking backward. That we can't really reflect on the meaning of something until we look back at it, because we don't, when we're in it, we don't really have that perspective. And there's some element of truth to that I certainly understand. I look back and I go, oh, now I get it. There seems to be this latency effect. I don't get it when I'm in the experience. I get it afterwards, and I look back and I go, oh, I get it now. Okay, got it.
It's sort of like the experience of being in it and the lessons learned can't all occupy the same space.
That's right.
You know?
When you're living it, you're living it, and when you're understanding it, then it's past. It's gone. But
yes,
you know,
it's
if you
gone.
Can still get the lessons, that's okay.
Absolutely. Don't you think, though, to have a fulfilling life, really it's just about living it?
Yeah, but it's amazing how many people fall asleep and don't live.
At the wheel, right.
You know,
they go into
a trance. I can't tell you the number of times I've stood in line at the grocery store and look at the people around me and their eyes look dead. They look like they're zombies, like they're sleepwalking. And it's like, wow, they look dead. I think there are a lot of people, it's just easier for many people to walk through life asleep and just do what you're expected to do and pay the bills and go to the PTA meeting and go to the gym and do this and do that, but not really be awake, because it's often uncomfortable to be awake.
Yes, and they also say, too, don't ruffle anybody's feathers. Just do what you're supposed to be doing, you know?
And we numb out. I mean, if you look at the addiction rate, the people who use alcohol, cigarettes, TV, pornography, shopping, I mean, anything to keep from just being present to the world as it is, it's hard to be awake, because everything we see isn't always pleasant or fun.
Yeah, and sometimes, too, when people will say their grievance with the world, and I'll say, okay, yeah, so what? You know? And they're like, what do you mean, so what? It has power. And it's like, it's only because you're giving it. So we have to remember that, is that we're giving it power. It doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to look at it that way either. You can change the way you are living, or you do have a choice with almost everything in the world, and that's
always
vitally important.
Always, yeah. But for some people, you know, being a victim is a choice too. There's a certain kind of power that they get out of that. They get the satisfaction of being self-righteous and pure, because nothing's their fault. And they get to complain about everything and be righteous without ever actually having to do anything. So, you know, there's people who live in the land of victimhood. And, you know, it's just a choice. It's just a choice. I don't fault them for living there. I just always ask them, I use the Dr. Phil question, how's that working for you? Are you getting,
absolutely.
Does being a victim get you the results you want? And if not, well, there's other ways to be in the world other than victim. It's just a choice. And it's okay if you want to stay there. It's okay. But, you know, I always come back to that question, is it giving you what you want in your life? And if it is, knock yourself out. But for most victims, it isn't. They just don't know any other way to be. They learned it from somebody. And but once you point out that there's another way to be and you show them how easy it is, they go, oh, then they snap right out of that victim mode.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's really great about your book is you have a lot of stories in here. You have tips, but then you also have a lot of questions and a lot of guidance and direction where people can read this and say, I don't quite understand that. Maybe I could read this, or maybe I don't quite understand how or where you're trying to guide me. And, you know, I could read through the steps and say, now I understand what you're trying to say.
Right. I didn't want the book to be just inspirational. I wanted it to be practical, too. And so at the end of every story, the person I was interviewing, I would ask them, okay, now what advice do you have for my readers? Because their story might be different from somebody else's story. So each and every story ends with anywhere from 1 to 3 tips from that person who lived it saying, okay, based on how I did it, here's the advice I'd give to people. And then at the end of each chapter, I'd throw in a few of my own tips. But it's not just stuff out of my head. It's out of the heads and the real lives of the people who've lived it, people who've changed careers, people who found true love, people who became athletic, you know, people who became wealthy, who decided they wanted to accumulate wealth later in life. That, you know, there's a chapter on just about everything that's important to people. Health, creativity, love, money. It's never too late.
And it's a great book, too, because you don't have to read it from cover to cover. You can just open it up and pick a page and say, and read that for that moment. So it definitely is something you could find something somewhere that might be important to you to be able to apply it that same day.
Absolutely. If it's love that's on your mind, go to the chapter on It's Never Too Late to Find True Love. Never mind the rest of the book. Go read that one first. Or if you're tired of being a couch potato and you want to be athletic, or you're tired of being poor and you want to make money, just go to whatever chapter floats your boat and read the stories there. And you can just read one story at a time and then go try some of the tips. So it's really... you know, it's really practical and easy and simple. I think the most important thing in any book is that it be accessible, that the average everyday person can jump in there, get something out of it, and go use it in their own life. And if the book does that, then it's a successful book.
Well, I think it's a successful book.
Thank you.
So, BJ, thank you so much for joining us. Would you share with the listeners a little more about your website and where they may be able to find out more information about you?
Sure. They can find me on the web. Oh, all sorts of places. I'm all over the place. They can find me on Twitter. They can find me on Facebook. They can find me on my website, bjgallagher.com. And I also write for Huffington Post just pretty much weekly. So they can, you know, they can follow me on Huffington Post. And I write about a lot of different subjects. I just had a story today posted about military brats. And so, you know, I'm easy to find.
Absolutely great. So thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. It was a real treat to be interviewed by somebody who has the same last name. I think we must be cousins. We must be cousins.
Absolutely.
So thank you
for somewhere along the line.
Maybe.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was really fun.
Thank you. If you'd like more information about BJ Gallagher's book, It's Never Too Late to Be What You Might Have Been, it's a guide to getting the life you love. It's an absolutely wonderful book because you'll find all kinds of tips in here, stories. And like we said, this is for some people, this is a new adventure. They're saying, you know, my life isn't working, but I really don't know what to do. These books are great because they'll spark your interest and you'll say, well, maybe, maybe not. Okay, that's too foreign. I can't do that. But, oh, man, I'd love to do that. So there's stories in here about how other people have done great adventures in their lives, many tips, inspirational quotes, and a lot of action. So you could say, I can do that, number one. I can do number 10. I can't do number 9. But it doesn't matter. It's just about getting up, doing something, making a point, and making a change. So I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. It's been a pleasure having you with us. And if you're joining us at this is now, we are now in December, please join us for our Health Blast 2015, which will be 55 plus now. Radio guests in 55 days. We'll probably be expanding it. Hopefully, maybe we'll make it to the 100 mark. You just never know. But there's all kinds of different authors, physicians, companies, products, inspiration, spiritual health, wellness. You just never know what you might find on there. So please do check out our website and also post a comment on each show as you find something interesting that we've had to say with the various authors and other guests. So thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and have a great day.